what I would say, let's say you're scaling into the US, right? I would first look to the diaspora network. I think that is a really unique advantage. There's this kind of ingrained compulsion to support other Irish, which I found incredible. I think that it's important to kind of understand the difference in approach in the US versus Ireland. And the best way to do that is tap into the Irish network. I would start tapping into that network as the first thing.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Irish Podcast, a podcast all about celebrating Irish innovation and Irish innovators globally. I'm your host, Dave Byrne. Thank you for tuning in to the Digital Irish Podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be talking to Chris Walla from Dogpatch Labs. This is a little bit of a continuation from last week's podcast, where we spoke to Dermot, who had spent some time in New York and then made the move back to Ireland, to Galway, to work in the startup ecosystem. Chris actually did the reverse. He actually started off in New York, moved to Ireland to work at Dogpatch Labs, and then now subsequently is moving back to New York. So between these two, I'm hoping to kind of get different perspectives of the overall startup ecosystem. What's great is, as you listen to the podcast, Chris even gives a shout out to the Galway startups ecosystem, similar to what Dermot was talking about in the last episode. Subsequently, we're actually going to have a couple of startups that are involved in Dogpatch Labs come onto the podcast. So we're going to continue on with a little bit of a theme going on here. So this episode, though, Chris has some great insights into, you know, what he saw in his time in Ireland, how that's evolved, and what he's taking back with him to New York. So really hope you enjoy this episode. I'm just going to drop you straight in it. Chris, thank you for taking out the time and joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
For those who are not familiar with you, you moved over to Ireland and got really involved in the Irish startup scene. Mm-hmm. I want to take you back firstly to before you actually moved over to Ireland. Like, what was the inspiration behind the move? Like, what attracted you to making the move over across the pond?
Yeah, it's funny. That's maybe the question that I get most often. I always joke that I did the reverse J1, and everyone in Ireland's like, why would you go the opposite way? Or you're supposed to, like, we're all trying to get to New York. Why'd you leave? And I mean, to me, New York's the greatest. I love New York. But at that point, I went to experience something abroad and try something outside of New York. I had the good fortune and benefit of always having kind of New York City in my back pocket, if you will. And I always kind of felt like I was going to be back. I was really intrigued by working in an emerging startup ecosystem abroad. And I felt that I could have a little bit more impact that way and be part of kind of a growth journey, which really excited me. So yeah, I was looking abroad. I was looking at emerging ecosystems, Melbourne, Paris, Berlin, Amsterdam. And to be honest, it wasn't that I necessarily chose Ireland, although that may be a better story. It was more so that I got connected to Dogpatch and to Patty, the founder, and I just connected with that mission of accelerating the development of the Irish startup ecosystem and really excited about where Ireland was in terms of the development of the ecosystem and where it was going. I was really kind of encapsulated by that, and I made the move. And to be honest, I didn't know anything about Ireland. I'm one of the few East Coast Americans that is actually has no Irish heritage. So I'd never been there, didn't know anyone there, did not really have any expectation that it would last more than 3 months. And then 5.5 years happened with a snap of the fingers. But it was great. And I say to everyone, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made, even though staying for 5 years wasn't like a deliberate decision, but it ended up working out really well.
And when you arrived, obviously you got very involved in Dogpatch, but, and we'll get to Dogpatch shortly, but for you coming over, what was the kind of the biggest shock to you about the state of the startup ecosystem at the time?
Yeah. I mean, I guess shock maybe implies negative, because my first impression of the startup ecosystem was not negative. It was broadly positive, to be honest. I mean, there were some elements that were negative. I mean, I guess the first negative that was immediately obvious was the expense of housing. I would have expected that housing prices in Dublin and city center be nowhere even remotely near New York City housing prices, but that was quite a wake-up call. So that was kind of the first and most obvious negative. Not that this is necessarily a negative, but it felt a bit Dublin-centric at the time, much more so than it feels now. I think the supports and the funding for entrepreneurs wasn't as extended into the regions as well. And it almost felt like a lot of the regional hubs and ecosystems in Ireland felt like separate ecosystems and separate markets entirely. I think also a lot of the biggest Irish wins that I had known of were happening abroad, like Stripe and Intercom, et cetera. And there was a bit of a brain drain of kind of the best talent in Ireland moving away to London, to the US, to Europe. So I definitely kind of noticed that, and Ireland losing some of their top scaling companies to international markets. Those are the negatives, but broadly, like I said, I had a pretty positive first impression. I think the amount of FDI investment was definitely shocking. Walking around a small city and seeing the European headquarters of the top technology companies in the world. I think Ireland has 9 of the top 10 global software companies, the European headquarters of 9 of the top 10 global software companies in the world. I mean, that's incredible, all in such a close proximity in a relatively small city. So I was pretty shocked when I was walking around all those headquarters of the big tech companies. Also the level of internationalization in Dublin, I think, in Ireland generally. I read that Ireland has a 17% foreign-born populations, which is one of the highest globally. And I don't think the Irish talk about that a lot, but for me, that was shocking. And then I guess the biggest positive for me that I kind of slowly learned over the time was this mentality of Team Ireland, this all-for-one, one-for-all mentality that the rising tide raises all ships, which I find to be quite unique and special. I was actually talking to David Beatty, was it yesterday or the day before? And he said, I'm sure he won't mind me quoting him or misquoting him. He said something along the lines of that he has this inexplicable compulsion to support Ireland and Irish entrepreneurs, even though he's lived in abroad and outside of Ireland for most of his adult life. And I really find that to be quite special. Maybe that's the New Yorker in me talking. I found that to be quite a stark difference where you get into Ireland and it's like, we're supporting each other. If one of us wins, we all win. And for a startup ecosystem, especially a growing and emerging one, that's really, really powerful. That really energized me. When I look back 5 years ago, kind of what the state of the ecosystem was then, it's easy to say, oh, it was a lot less advanced than it is now, because you can see, like, you know, hindsight 2020. But to be honest, there was a lot of positive signals at that point, and that's what kind of energized me to stay.
And you touched on when you originally arrived, it was very Dublin-centric, and you saw it kind of progress to be more countrywide. Were there any other evolutions that you saw over the 5.5 years that added to the vibrancy that you found when you initially arrived?
That's definitely a big element of it, kind of the regionalization or the regional connectedness of the country and the ecosystem. I think COVID actually was kind of a stimulant to that. During COVID, obviously everyone immediately went into remote work, and a lot of that was people that were entrepreneurs and other people in the ecosystem that were working in Dublin, because that was, you know, the hub of the ecosystem, moved back home to their counties and continued working from there. And I think that kind of was a forcing function to the regionalization and the regional approach. At that time, kind of during COVID, we had created this Irish Tech Hub network of the top 5 startup hubs across the country. And the idea was that each of those hubs have their own kind of smaller network of hubs within their region. So through this network of this kind of hub and spoke model that we said, we would be able to connect all the even micro ecosystems, if you will, of the country into kind of a full singular ecosystem. And I think that was actually a really important inflection point, because it created this kind of function of shared resources, shared knowledge, more of a global mindset. And it felt like we then shifted from thinking of individual ecosystems within the country to the entire country being itself a singular ecosystem. And then from that thinking, okay, we're not competing internally within this island. We're competing as an island versus, you know, the other top ecosystems in Europe. So I think it raised the ambition of Ireland, especially when you see small countries like, let's say, Estonia. Estonia is one of the top ranked startup ecosystems in Europe and leading in certain categories like angel investment. And Estonia is a fifth of the population of Ireland. So I think the excuse of, oh, you know, we may be too small to compete with the likes of the UK or France, et cetera, is not really, like, kind of dissipated, right? And I think this belief that Ireland could be a top global ecosystem started to take shape. And I truly believe in that. So the regional connectedness is something that is actually a bit of a superpower for Ireland. I think I remember we had the leaders of the French ecosystem come to visit us. Was it last year, I think? And I mean, they're one of the most advanced ecosystems in Europe. And they were constantly asking us questions about this regional approach. For them, it's pretty much Paris and then the rest. So it's actually, I think it's actually quite unique, is what I've seen. That's kind of the main thing that I would say I've seen evolve. The other thing is, I think over time, and as the ecosystem has matured, it's gone into this kind of second stage where the large exits and the global successes of top entrepreneurs have created this kind of second wave of entrepreneurs that has been supported by those early founders. And whereas the ecosystem at the start was very much government-led with their funding and support, it has kind of evolved to being now government-backed, but founder-led, like we've kind of say, Dogpatch. Founders, sharing their expertise with the next generation of entrepreneurs, raising that ambition level. Even look at like a program like NDRC, which is one of Dogpatch's accelerators. There's 100 mentors on that program that are all giving their time for free that are some really successful entrepreneurs that are mentoring the next batch of founders. So that has been a huge benefit to the country as well. I mean, there's a bunch of other things like kind of the relationship between FDI and startups becoming more symbiotic, et cetera. But those I would say the main things that come to mind.
Obviously, we've mentioned Dogpatch now a few times. Mm-hmm. I feel like that we should explain what that is for the folks that may not be familiar. So would you mind explaining what Dogpatch is and what your role at Dogpatch has been?
I recognize that it's maybe not the simplest concept to communicate, but we call ourselves a startup hub, and our mission is to accelerate the development of the Irish startup ecosystem. So we kind of see ourselves as a kind of catalyst for the ecosystem and a neutral platform for all, you know, stakeholders and sectors of that ecosystem to engage and really be that central connector for where everyone kind of feels like they have a place, and we can begin to level up all sectors of the ecosystem. And when I say sectors of the ecosystem, I guess it's important to note that a startup ecosystem is not just startups. There are a lot of key stakeholders and elements and factors that need to be aligned in order for a startup to have kind of the proper environment for their own growth. You know, startups is a huge element of that, but then you also have, you know, venture capital and the investment environment, corporates, social enterprise, universities, government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these pieces of the ecosystem need to be aligned. And if there's a gap across this ecosystem, it can actually be a detriment to everyone in the ecosystem, right? And you can see, you can have those knock-on effects. So for us, we look at the ecosystem holistically. We understand kind of the founder's journey and think about where there are gaps and where we can make and how we can make Ireland the best place to found a company and to scale your company. So what does that actually kind of operationally look like in Dogpatch? Like, what are our functions? At kind of the basic layer, we are a co-working space and community of entrepreneurs everywhere, from kind of solo founders taking a hot desking space to larger scaling startups that maybe take a private office. And the idea is that you can scale your company within Dogpatch and grow within our space. And we run events and we kind of curate that community. Now, that's the basic layer. On top of that, we run corporate innovation programs. So we partner with some of the largest companies in the world, let's say Fidelity and Huawei and NatWest Group, USB. And we help them work more effectively with startups and to kind of support their innovation functions. So they actually come in-house into Dogpatch, and we run these kind of sprint programs, whether it be an incubator or an accelerator, to kind of bridge that gap between them and startups. I can get into the kind of details of that. And then the next layer is kind of these startup accelerators. So these are, like the NDRC program, which is the national accelerator, programs to basically accelerate the development of founders in their companies. And again, we bring in top entrepreneurs to kind of help mentor them and support them with different functional expertise like marketing and sales, et cetera. And then kind of what envelops all of that is that's kind of like ecosystem development activity element of leveling up the entire ecosystem. And to be honest, what Dogpatch does has evolved very significantly over time. I know that it will continue to evolve as the ecosystem evolves, because the role that is needed in the ecosystem will continue to change. When I started at Dogpatch, it was primarily a co-working space for startups and a community of startups. And we were running our first startup accelerator at that time. And it has really evolved since and pivoted and grown a lot since. And I know it will continue to do so.
I love how in-depth you went there. So that was really, really interesting to hear. One thing that you mentioned there was actually understanding, like, kind of working with governments and winning some key government contracts. And I know that Dogpatch actually won some key government contracts, notably for the NDRC. From a business development perspective, like, I'm sure that there's startup founders right now that are kind of considering applying for some of these government contracts. Mm-hmm. What are some of the key tips or ideas that folks should keep in mind when they're considering these contracts, especially in their early growth strategy?
I'm realizing now that I did not answer the second part of your previous question, which is what I do at Dogpatch. So a good segue is, so I lead business development for Dogpatch, which includes corporate partnerships, strategic partnerships and growth opportunities, as well as kind of public contracts and tenders. So good segue into this. In the first few years of our journey, I won't say shunned, the public funding opportunity, but we didn't really consider it very strongly. COVID was a real forcing function for us on that front. Our primary revenue stream going into COVID was our co-working. And you can imagine instantly that went to zero during the lockdown, and we stopped charging our members for space. So we needed to think of something pretty drastic to kind of start support. Well, not drastic, but to really, really need to kind of look at our operation and how we could pivot. At that time, the NDRC contract, which is the government contract for the National Accelerator, was coming up for tender, 5-year, 17 million euro contract. So we decided to go for it. We had, how many people were on our team? Maybe 20 or so. And almost every person on our team was contributing to the writing of that tender. It was the first one we had really ever done. We ended up winning that contract, which was fantastic for us. And again, a really big inflection point for our company as we kind of started really leaning into these kind of accelerator programs. Ever since then, we really started considering public funding as a business development strategy much more significantly. I would say that it's a really important stream to consider. It's guaranteed income on a long-term contract and oftentimes pretty high value. How often, as a startup, how often are you going to secure a 5-year contract worth multi-millions? And especially now in this economy and the uncertainty around it, and a lot of contracts, corporate contracts and things like this, may be evaporating. a government contract like that provides a level of certainty for multiple years that will take us through a economic downturn like this. And the Irish procurement market and the Irish and UK procurement market has grown 7% per annum since 2019. There was 20 billion euros spent in 2022, right? So that's a huge market to tap into and not to look away from. And that I would encourage founders to really lean into that, especially now when the private market may be a little bit more difficult in this economic kind of landscape. I think in terms of your question around tips and tricks on kind of how to win government contracts, I mean, there's loads of them. I think some of the key things that I've learned is that for a lot of these government tenders or public tenders, there's a bit of a repeatable formula. And if you can create an internal capability around writing these tenders, you will ensure you're to an extent always ready and that you're not starting from scratch. Those who compete for public tenders frequently and often are the ones that win most of them because they have a formula, because they have a process, because they have their tools in place. And it's not to say that you need to have a full-time headcount on, you know, government contracts. Like, no, for sure not. I mean, maybe if you're big enough. But the point is that you can actually prepare a lot of these resources and templates in advance to put you at a really strong starting point when something does come up. The other thing I would say is to really focus on differentiation and think about, like, you as a company, what do you bring to the table that is unique in comparison to other bidders and in comparison to any incumbent that you're bidding against? And a lot of times your differentiating factors will be the same differentiating factors for almost any tender that you bid for. You know, for example, when we bid for the NDRC tender, the differentiating factor was this regional network that I just talked about that we created during COVID. Previously, the NDRC accelerator was very Dublin-centric. It was run out of Dublin exclusively, and it didn't really tap into the full, in my opinion, it didn't really tap into the full expertise and potential of founders across the island. You'd kind of have to move to Dublin in order to participate in this program. Now the NDRC is decentralized across the island. So you can be a top entrepreneur in Galway and you don't necessarily have to move to Dublin in order to participate in this program. So again, this is a differentiating factor for us and it was something that helped us win that contract. Another tip I would say is I would suggest bringing hiring an expert on public tenders that can keep an eye on the tender and on the kind of the public procurement landscape for you and notify you when there's a tender that's coming up that you are well positioned for. So you don't have to do that yourself. Like that's what I did. I didn't have time to constantly be looking at kind of e-tenders and looking at the European investment landscape and saying, okay, what do we qualify for? Reading all these long RFP documents. No, I had someone that knew Dogpatch well, knew our capabilities, and emailed me and said, hey, Chris, like I think there's something here that you might want to consider bidding for. So that's what I would say as well. It wouldn't be expensive to have someone like that. And the last thing I would say, sorry for this long-winded answer, but I can see the value of is using AI tools to actually help you write tenders. Things like ChatGPT, et cetera, to actually help you draft. You may not be the best copywriter, so right? So things like these tools will actually help you draft the language necessary to complete these contracts and use them as a resource, and it'll save you a lot of time.
A quick pause in today's podcast. If you listen to the podcast regularly, you'll probably know that we like to really focus in on one innovator or one business as we go through the episode. We're going to be experimenting a little bit moving forward. You're going to hear a few different changes. I may even present some news directly to you. We're also going to be experimenting a little bit with the format. We would love to hear your thoughts on this. So please, if you listen regularly and you have feedback, if you like something that we've done, please email hello@digitalirish.com. Now back to the interview. Have you had success in utilizing some of these AI chat functionalities in drafting some of the work that you're doing?
I'm leaning into it a little bit more now. I think I hadn't really that strongly considered it. Now, even like looking back at some of the tenders and elements that I've written, I just as a exercise, I typed in kind of a prompt and a brief into ChatGPT and said, you know, produce a formal answer for a public procurement contract, right? And, you know, not that that kind of like output is what you should submit, but like that would have been a really good starting point. And to take that and then to edit from that and I think it would be helpful. Now, I can't say it for certain because I actually haven't done it kind of for a full contract to date, but I would, if I were an entrepreneur, if I were someone thinking about these public tenders, I would strongly consider that.
So it's almost like a good, it may be also a good way of just kind of almost like double checking your work and kind of.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I like that. I mean, I think like this goes beyond just like public tenders and procurement, right? I think if I were advice to kind of founders would be lean into AI, even if you're not an AI company. I think just how every company now is a digital company, even if they're selling physical goods or, you know, their actual end product is not a digital product. I believe soon every company will be an AI company, even if their product isn't AI driven. And that's to say that every company should be leaning into AI to make your operations more efficient, you know, for content creation, marketing tools, process automation, you know, summarizing long documents, HR, etc. This is like, you will be doing yourself a disservice if you don't start looking into these things and how it can make your operation more efficient. And I think that is almost inevitable now, and you can be getting ahead of your competition if you start early.
I love this. And, you know, thinking about like some of the other business development work that you've done, like, mm-hmm. you know, and some of the points that we've already touched on, but like, you know, thinking of the Irish ecosystem right now, when businesses are kind of taking off right now, like what are their kind of advantages can the Irish startup specifically kind of tap into? Like what, I mean, you know, you mentioned the connectiveness of Ireland itself, but let's say if a company has aspirations beyond that, like what do you think some of the advantages that these startups have at their fingertips?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good question. I think what I would say, let's say you're scaling into the US, right? I would first look to the diaspora network. I think that is a really unique advantage. There's this kind of ingrained compulsion to support other Irish, which I found incredible. I think that it's important to kind of understand the difference in approach in the US versus Ireland, and right? The US is a very different market than in the sense that it's a lot bigger. You know, sales is kind of a different beast. And, you know, attracting talent, immigration, marketing, et cetera. Like the best way to do that is tap into the Irish network. I would start tapping into that network as the first thing and speak to those, you know, Irish Americans or Irish expats that are, let's say, in New York or in San Francisco, and talk to them about this. I think, you know, first of all, they may be advisors or angel investors for you, but they'll also be willing to share their expertise. So that would be the first thing that I would say. Generally in Ireland, there's a lot of skilled engineering and multilingual sales talent. And I think now with all these tech layoffs, there's particularly a high amount of really high quality and skilled operators in Ireland that may have just been laid off, and they may now be considering, should I go back to my home country? Should I go to another tech company? What do I do? And a lot of them now are considering entrepreneurship because they kind of have to look at all their options. And I think if I were a founder, I would be really excited about that because it's a unique opportunity to be able to snatch some incredible, let's say, engineering talent from some of these companies or sales talent. Whereas previously, you wouldn't be able to compete with the package that Google's offering, right? If I mean, put yourself in the shoes of, let's say, a salesperson at Google, where you know you're getting paid a very high wage. There's a dentist in the office. There's a pool there. Your gym is there. Your social network is there. It's like it would be very hard otherwise. You know, you have three meals a day there. It'd be very hard otherwise to kind of make that plunge into entrepreneurship where you don't really have any of those benefits. But now that kind of has been flipped on its head and you actually have a shot at bringing a lot of these people onto the team or onto your team or co-founding with them. So I would, in the short term, that's something that I would definitely think about.
You know, one thing I was just thinking of there is that, when you look at the recession in 2008, so many great like unicorns came out of that time. People kind of using this opportunity to kind of say, hey, like, you know, the big companies aren't hiring, they're downsizing, like this is the opportunity to like step forward. And like, to your point, it's like, there's great engineering talent, there's great marketing talent, there's great just general talent that could be more swayed by this right now. And it feels like that you know, there's if somebody right now, I'm even thinking of like maybe people who have been in those tech roles for many years, this may be a good forcing function for them as well to finally take that idea that they have and try it out and experiment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is like, again, another, just as kind of COVID was a forcing function for different, you know, maturity points in the ecosystem, so is this, in a different sense, right? We in Ireland, there was, I think, an over-reliance on FDI in the ecosystem, foreign direct investment, and the talent that I brought in. And I think at the earlier stages of the ecosystem, we had not seen to the full extent the trickle-down effects of that kind of FDI strategy into entrepreneurship and startups. And actually, a pretty low percentage of, you know, the FDI talent were starting companies. And again, a lot of what I said before to you is, you know, so many of these benefits in this package that a lot of these big tech companies are giving them, it's you can't blame them. It's hard to leave that. But I think now it's in some weird way, if there had to be some silver lining around this, and I do fully recognize that it really sucks to lose your job. But the silver lining for the ecosystem is that a lot of these, you know, really talented individuals that may have come over to Ireland to work at a Google or a Facebook or a Microsoft are now maybe considering, you know, working in indigenous companies and startups and entrepreneurship, or maybe starting a company themselves. And I think that's great. And I think Ireland now needs to think about pivoting to making the most supportive environment for those people to choose that. And I look at a company like Intercom, right? A really good example of this. Intercom is Ireland's first unicorn. And I think they've really been very successful in instilling an internal culture of the entrepreneurial spirit. In fact, they even have an internal group called Outercom. I think it's a Slack group called Outercom, which is, you know, internal staff thinking about startup ideas, developing those ideas, and, you know, ending up spinning them out. And you know, I think a lot of companies would have this kind of approach of, oh, we don't want to encourage that because we're going to lose our top talent. But I actually think that's the wrong way to think about it, because it's really a flywheel. Like these people may be champions for your business for years to come, may solve solutions for your company, or may even end up back into your company. And I'll take an example like Vidu, right? So Gavin and Will were, that was a sales guy and engineering guy in Intercom. Internally, kind of, they created this sales tool that they thought would solve an internal problem, ended up catching a lot of traction, and they spun it out and they started their own company, and that's Vidu now, which is a really fantastic startup. Intercom ended up being their first customer and an investor. So if you kind of start fostering this spirit, you will keep your employees more engaged. You will support the ecosystem more ways, and you will kind of stimulate these wins like Vidu. And there's other startups that have spun out of Intercom, like GradGuide or Canna. So I think that's really important. And I think I would love to see that as kind of like the next evolution of the Irish startup ecosystem, is the trickle-down effects of this FDI investment that the country has made and really was a significant win. Now seeing that have much more tangible effects on the startup ecosystem. And I'm seeing it already.
That, I love that. And, you know, it's great to see that you're already seeing it, but it's also, it's fascinating to hear just how much potential could come from this as well. Mm-hmm. If it's like, if it's invested in correctly, and if people really, dedicate the correct resourcing to it. It really truly feels like that, you know, between the advantages and the opportunities, and just with, almost like this feeling that, right, there's no time like the present to find great talent.
Right.
There's almost like this potential perfect storm for a few founders to really find success, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, that is an optimistic way of looking at it. And I do feel optimistic about the situation. I must say that it's not all roses, right? Capital is not flowing as freely at the early stages or late stages for startups, particularly at the late stages, as it was previously. So yes, it is going to be harder. But I do think that will force companies to be more commercially aware, commercially robust, maybe consider bootstrapping if they hadn't before. And I think in the long term, it'll make more companies that are likely to last the test of time. One thing I really was thinking about was, over the last few years, all the Web3 and crypto projects and startups that were spinning out, and just how easy it was for them to raise capital. And because of that, I found that a lot of them didn't really have much of a business model. And I think this has kind of been a bit of a wake-up call to founders and to entrepreneurs to really, make sure that they have a very robust business model, that they seek operational excellence and do more with less money, and not just raise because it's available, because now it's not, or lesser, to a lesser extent. And to build real value for now, rather than relying on, this future value, or this value in 10 years that they're going to create, that, that will be propped up by venture funding until then, right? I think it's going to be very important to solve painful problems that are felt in the present, and to solve problems that people are willing to pay for, even if they're, going to be tighter on their wallets. So again, I'm still optimistic. It's going to be harder, but I'm still optimistic about it, that it will produce some really robust, commercially aware companies that will last for the long run. And like you alluded to, some of the best tech companies that we even have today are the ones that have been founded in that recession. And it's been kind of it's kind of mixed things up a little bit and created a lot of opportunity. So I think it's difficult, but it's not something to shy away from.
And, you mentioned there, obviously, that purse strings are being tightened. That there is maybe some less kind of investment funds actually out there right this moment. But, again, what advice would you give to a founder who is kind of like looking at an early round funding or a Series A right now? Like, what should they be considering as they kind of go out during these tougher economic times?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, going back to my previous point, like, I think that it's important to look, whereas venture funding might've been kind of the more obvious route, I think it's important to look at other opportunities as well. Like what I mentioned about public funding, there's a lot of public funding available. And in many ways it has its advantages, right? You don't have to give up your equity for public funding. So look at that. There's a lot of European funding out there, and just explore it. The other thing is, think about, not necessarily, maybe bootstrapping is not for everyone, but think about how you can start driving value in the short term and actually generating revenue, because it is more reliable. But yeah, I mean, look, it's going to be different on a case by case basis. I don't know if I'm necessarily an expert on kind of raising around, but that's what I would encourage people to do, is kind of be a little bit more open minded about some other routes.
I think that's great advice. I mean, there's no one route to success. There's multiple different mm-hmm. routes. And I think when you're in an environment like today's, I think exploring multiple routes, and I think, as startup founders, the need to pivot is always present, whether that be on how you get your funding.
Absolutely.
Or how you build your team, how you build your product. So it seems like that it's just like maintain that flexibility and be ready to pivot seems to be.
Yeah, consistent. Absolutely. I mean, I think that has been maybe one of my biggest learnings over the last few years, is that the starting point is never the ending point, right? And I think the biggest thing, I mean, look, a lot of entrepreneurs have this ingrained in them, but the idea that you will be constantly pivoting and your result may be almost unrecognizable to your starting point, but that's part of the process, right? And you need to embrace that. And I always love this phrase, strong opinions loosely held, in the sense, which is the sense of like having a lot of conviction in what you believe, and being passionate about it, but also be willing to be convinced against that and be willing to pivot and change your ideas. And I think that's what creates the best entrepreneurs, particularly in such an uncertain landscape like this one.
So after your 5.5 years, you're now making the move back to the US. What are some of the learnings that you think you're going to take back with you here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, to me, look, having worked at through Dogpatch at this kind of intersection between large corporates and FDIs and startups, I really think that it's very, it may be daunting when you think about your competitor as, your competitor may be Google or Microsoft or whatever, and it seems like they have unlimited resourcing and expertise and the top engineers in the world and unlimited budget, right? And it's hard to think about going head to head with any of these companies. But I truly believe a small, hyper-focused team solving a specific problem that they're passionate about and determined to solve, they will win, and no matter how many resources or market access maybe they compete against, I believe that they will win. So I'm really inspired about that. And I think that I truly believe in entrepreneurs being able to solve the biggest problems that our world faces. So I want to keep on working to empower them. And the other thing that I kind of bring back is, for me, that like I said before, this Irish diaspora network is very strong, and I want to hopefully keep building ties between Ireland and the US. I've already found that there's a huge amount of goodwill in the US, in the Irish diaspora, for Ireland. I think it's the second largest diaspora in Europe behind Portugal. And this is kind of the superpower because of this give back attitude, because of this Team Ireland attitude. It's a cultural attitude that I think is hard to foster and does not exist strongly in other ecosystems, at least that I've seen. And it's an intangible factor that will continue to be Ireland's superpower. And I truly believe that Ireland can be one of the top countries in the world for entrepreneurship and innovation, and Ireland's well on the way.
I love that. It sounds like you're very excited to kind of keep this connection even as you move back here, which is great. And, for folks that are listening who are based in New York, we're, Hopefully, Chris, we'll be able to see you at more and more Digital Irish events in New York as well. I think, like, to close out, like, you know, what are you excited about for the future? Like, what are the things that you're hoping to see in the next, like, 12 months, like, now that you're kind of making the move back?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm excited to be part of a somewhat, for me, new ecosystem, to kind of understand the lay of the land here and again, start building those ties. I think it's really exciting. I've found that there's a lot of obviously amazing entrepreneurs here, and I'm looking forward to be a part of it.
Amazing stuff. Well, Chris, we're excited to have you back in New York, I should say, rather than moving to New York. And we're excited to get you more and more involved in the Digital Irish community. So, but for now, just thank you so much for sharing your insights, your learnings, and your experience of working in the Irish startup ecosystem.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate it and enjoy chatting.
If you have an idea for a guest on a future episode of the Digital Irish podcast, please email hello@digitalirish.com. Here's a preview of our next episode.
I think every founder definitely struggle with the, am I working hard enough? Because I'm not working till midnight every night, is that not good enough, you know? And you constantly have this feeling of, oh my gosh, should I be doing more? Should I be totally burnt out, you know? How do you really do mindfulness? Even if it's just a few minutes a day, the more that you can remove yourself from it, it actually benefits your instincts, your gut, your entire being. So difficult to do, and that's why finding something that does remove yourself from it is like a gift.
Thank you as always for listening. Please do share this podcast if you found it interesting. Also, don't forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you next time.